Good evening, and thanks for joining us on The Week in Review. I'm Brandis Friedman. Nick Blumberg has the evening off. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell visits Chicago and brings with him a stark warning.
The level of tariff increases announced so far is significantly larger than anticipated, and the same is likely to be true of the economic effects, which will include higher inflation and slower growth.
Those remarks drew a blistering response from President Donald Trump.
I'm not happy with him. I let him know it, and if I want him out, he'll be out of there real fast, believe me.
Former President Joe Biden was also in Chicago to deliver his first major speech since leaving office and took immediate aim at the Trump administration, accusing it of taking a hatchet to Social Security.
They want to wreck it so they can rob it.
Meanwhile, the Trump administration doubles down on its deportation of a man sent to a prison in El Salvador, despite previously calling it a mistake.
He's in El Salvador, and that's where the president plans on keeping him.
The Chicago City Council blocks participants in the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol from holding city jobs.
Traitors to the country should not be allowed to work for the city of Chicago.
Plus, Chicago teachers ratify a contract. The city is on the brink of exhausting its budget to pay for police misconduct, and Northwestern says it will continue to fund at-risk scientific research amid a federal funding freeze. And now to our Week in Review panel. Joining us are Steve Daniels from the Chicago Tribune, our own Heather Sharon of WTTW News, Elvia Malagon from the Chicago Sun-Times, and from Block Club Chicago, Melody Mercado. Let's get right to it. Welcome, everybody. Good to see you. So, Heather, Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, appointed by President Trump during his first term, was in Chicago Wednesday speaking to the Economic Club of Chicago, making comments that didn't go over so well with the president.
Not so much.
Did he say?
Well, he was explaining how tariff works, that it will serve as an inflationary force in the economy. It will make the prices of goods rise across the board, and that will make it tougher for people to, you know, make ends meet. The president did not want to hear that because, in his mind, tariffs work in a way that defies time and space and gravity. And Jerome Powell was trying to bring that back to earth.
Steve, you're a former business journalist. Anything from Powell's talk of like the likely economic impact of tariffs, anything that struck you as out of line?
No, I mean, he spoke honestly. I think he has a difficult job with Donald Trump as president because he knows, and any economist knows, how tariffs, particularly tariffs that size, will affect the economy in the short run. And Trump makes the argument about, in the longer run, this will bring jobs back to the U.S., and we're looking at it that way. The Fed, Fed chairman's job is to manage the economy right now. And so he was, explaining that. But it's a delicate thing when Donald Trump doesn't want that message advertised and also is beating on the Fed chairman to lower interest rates, which is happening, by the way, in Europe. So Trump is, upset about that because he thinks that would help the economy and help him politically.
Does the Fed have any room to cut interest rates, as Trump is pushing them to do?
Well, they can always do that, sure.
But how would it go?
Well, the idea, the rates are relatively high. They certainly could cut them, but they don't want to stoke inflation. And if you've got already inflationary effects happening due to tariffs, then probably what you don't want to do is further stoke that. I think that's the way they're looking at it. They're also being cautious. They're saying, well, we need to see how all of this chaos plays out.
Powell also, he addressed the U.S. national debt, which currently stands at more than $36 trillion and rising.
U.S. federal debt is on an unsustainable path. It's not at an unsustainable level. And no one really knows how much further we can go. This is a situation that we very much need to address. Sooner or later we'll have to, and sooner is better than later.
Now, Melody, that message would seem to conflict with the president, Republicans who are intent on pushing through further tax cuts that would add to that debt. Is this something that Americans, particularly voters, are concerned about, the national debt?
I think they're more concerned whether they can afford eggs, milk, and now small business owners were worrying whether or not they can afford the tariffs that are extremely high and are affecting the way they can continue to run their business. So I think, you know, although the national debt is something to always be concerned about, I don't think for the average American that is what they're concerned about. They're concerned about inflation.
Heather, President Trump, he's now calling for Powell's termination, as we heard in that soundbite earlier. But isn't the Fed chair, isn't the Fed supposed to be operating independently? Can he do that?
No, question mark,
basically.
So, you know, you saw the Dow sort of drop precipitously after the president made those remarks, because I think a lot of investors, especially institutional investors, would find the dismissal of a Fed chair very concerning. There are a number of cases working their ways through the court where the president has moved to terminate the heads of so-called independent federal agencies, and it will be eventually up to the Supreme Court to decide whether the president has exceeded his authority. If they find that he has not exceeded his authority in firing those independent agency heads, I think it would become more likely that the president moves to terminate Powell before his term ends. If the Supreme Court blocks those firings, it is unclear what the president will do.
And Steve, the markets have already had whiplash from Trump's tariff announcements. How are the markets likely to respond if he does fire the Fed chair?
Well, what Heather said is right. I mean, so Powell's term is up next year. It's not like he's
not there forever.
He's not there for. You've got to go through the entire Supreme Court process. These first cases they're going to have to adjudicate. If they indeed do rule that the president has the ability to remove these independent agency heads, then the next step would be to fire Powell. There would be some sort of litigation or lawsuit to try to block that. It would probably go back to the Supreme Court. By the time you get to the point where he's actually able to remove him, his term might be practically up. So, but it certainly adds to the sense of chaos, the sense of not being able to predict what the Fed's going to do. Who's in charge of the Fed is part of how you figure out what interest rates are going to be. So, in some respects, obviously, if there was some idea the Fed was going to cut interest rates, at least in the short term, stock market would go up on that news.
Elvia, haven't forgotten about you. former President Joe Biden was in Chicago this week making his first public major speech since leaving office. They typically keep a lower profile. And in it, of course, he assailed the Trump administration for undermining Social Security. What did he say?
Yeah, he was here to speak to disability groups. And his main message was that we all have paid into Social Security, so we should. It's not as how the Trump administration is characterizing it as being some sort of scam or some kind of waste, because what former President Biden was saying was that we have all paid into it and everyone should have access to it. He also made some pretty strong political remarks regarding that, you know, no one should be king, things like that. So it was kind of the first time that we've heard President Biden since all of this has happened.
Do you think people are listening to him on this, or is he yesterday's news? Does anybody want to hear from the old guard?
I think he's a bit of yesterday's news, unfortunately. I think so much has happened and everyone is trying to keep up with all the changes, all the different lawsuits. Is this group losing federal funding? What's going on with the workers? It's just been so much chaos that I do think that strong voice from a Democratic leader has been lost.
What does everybody else think? Are we sick of Biden? Are the Democrats over him?
I mean, I think given that, you know, he had to sort of drop out of the presidential election, we still haven't really heard from the former Vice President Kamala Harris. You know, she's sort of weighing her political future. I think that there will be much more attention focused on her and sort of whether she seeks to sort of grab the mantle of leadership for the Democratic Party. But she's got a number of challengers, Cory Booker and his record-breaking filibuster, and, of course, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the New York congresswoman who's barnstorming the country, getting huge crowds to talk about the need to fight the president and stand up against his efforts.
Yeah, I'm going to imagine that most Democratic leaders would probably prefer he stay on the sidelines. You know, he's the reason that they lost to Trump, let's just be honest. And coming out and being the voice is not, I don't think, what most Democratic leaders are looking for right now.
Melody?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think, like we said, we're barely 100 days in. into the Trump presidency. I was a little surprised to see Biden so soon. But I also think he's not the face that people were wanting to see or the voice that people were hoping to hear from.
Deportation, obviously, been a big deal this week as well. Country seems to be barreling towards maybe a constitutional crisis as the administration is refusing to comply with a U.S. district judge's order, calling it a clear violation of a Supreme Court order to return a man who has been mistakenly deported to El Salvador to bring him back to the U.S. In that blistering opinion, Fourth Court Circuit of Appeals Chief Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson, who was appointed by Ronald Reagan, by the way, said it is difficult in some cases to get to the very heart of the matter, but in this case, it is not hard at all. The government is asserting a right to stash away residents of this country in foreign prisons without the semblance of due process. That is the foundation of our constitutional order. It goes on to say, this should be shocking not only to judges, but to the intuitive sense of liberty that Americans far removed from courthouses still hold dear. It would reduce the rule of law to lawlessness and tarnish the very values for which Americans of diverse views and persuasions have always stood. They know how to write it, don't they? Because that's pretty clear there. Melody, since the Trump administration shows no inclination to back down, are we already in a constitutional crisis? Should people be worried?
I was worried the second they said they weren't going to send him back, when they had the leader of El Salvador in the White House, and he said, how would I smuggle him in and refer to him as a terrorist? And so I think the question here is, how far is the Trump administration willing to go? Reading, you know, the judge's remarks, it was just like very astounding how pointed he was in throughout the whole thing, and just saying there is no choice. This goes against our Constitution, and you need to bring him back, and you need to actually be making the effort to bring him back. So I think we're all just kind of waiting with bated breath to see what the administration will do, but it doesn't seem like they're going to back down.
What about the rest of you? Constitutional crisis, are we there?
I think either very close or yes. I think one of the biggest things that's concerning is what happens when someone goes to this prison in El Salvador. We know how the criminal system works here, or even the civil process of immigration court. You know, there's a due process, there's appeals. Even for someone who has the harshest sentence of a death penalty, there's still an appeals process. There's still a process that people can follow. But in El Salvador, from everything I've read, the only way to get out of that prison is if you die. So I think that's very troubling. And my coworker, Adriana at WBZ, wrote a story about how a man who was from Venezuela and was living in South Shore, he's also at that prison as well. And so the question is, what happens to people? There seems like there's no due process.
The videos, the images that we see from that prison as well are pretty striking. U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi, she is insisting that Abrego Garcia is not going to be allowed back. And presumably this could be back in front of the Supreme Court. Steve, do you think the administration will refuse to comply with an even more explicit order from a higher court?
Well, that's the question. And I don't think this, I think we're not there yet. So we editorialized on this, and we certainly said that he needs to be brought back. But the Supreme Court gave, with the verbiage that they used, gave the administration some room to interpret it that if El Salvador didn't act, then they didn't have to do anything. That it was sort of, the ball was in El Salvador's court, which is, you know, I think defies logic, but that was the loophole that they left. If it comes back to them and they're more pointed and more direct and say, no, we really meant it, then we're at a different level of crisis than we're at right now. So we're just not there yet. And I do think I detect some nervousness on the Trump side in terms of how this is going and how the narrative is going. So I think we just need to wait and see.
Okay.
I think that it was really interesting to see, senior Senator Chuck Grassley in Iowa, even at a town hall in a place where I used to do some reporting. It's a deeply red state, and even seeing some of the voters in the room saying, "You need to bring him back." And I was very astounded to see that. That's not something that I would have expected from voters for Senator Grassley, but it's starting to happen.
I think people are getting the idea that, hey, if you can do this to this guy, you can take it a step further. If you defy the Supreme Court and just, if we pick somebody up and just by mistake send them to another country and to a prison, then all bets are off. We have no further responsibility.
That an immigration judge said, don't send him back to that one. Like, that is the one protection that he actually did have from an immigration attorney. Because we're also seeing international students. They are losing their visas both here in Illinois, across the country. Illinois has some 55,000 international students, making us, I think, the fifth highest population in the country of international students. Steve, what impact is this going to have on universities if more and more students lose their visas?
Well, that's a good, that's an interesting way of looking at it, because the universities have depended on international students for huge amounts of their revenue really for the last 10, 20 years. And University of Illinois certainly is in that place, the University of Chicago, really all of them to one degree or another. So if that is cut off or greatly reduced, that is going to create significant fiscal problems for those universities. It's going to mean the price potentially for people in state to attend university might have to go up. So the ramifications of all of this are really multifaceted.
The pressure that the president is putting on the universities as well, it's about a number of things, right? But, all of it involves, taking back federal money if you don't do this, that, and the other. A lot of it, though, has been tied to how the universities handle anti-Semitism on campus. Is this about anti-Semitism or something else?
I mean, I think we've seen a fair amount of argument that the president was determined to sort of attack, for lack of a better verb, universities for what he found to be sort of a support for, left-leaning ideas. And I've read a number of sort of opinion pieces that said if it wasn't anti-Semitism, it would have been something else, and that this is essentially pretextual. I think Harvard and, Columbia have both said we have taken significant steps to address every instance of anti-Semitism that we can have seen. We have taken significant sort of disciplinary actions against students. That has not been sufficient for the Trump administration, and they seem unwilling to sort of make sure that they're towing a line between protecting Jewish students and ensuring that people have free speech. I think that raises questions about sort of the underpinning of the whole movement.
Elvia, meanwhile in Chicago, ICE is claiming that Mayor Brandon Johnson's team hired a film crew to document ICE arrests. How did this claim emerge, and what did the mayor's office say?
It's part of the federal lawsuit that the government has against Chicago, Cook County, and the state for their sanctuary policies. Essentially, ICE would really like to get into places like the Cook County Jail so they can facilitate detaining more immigrants, because this is part of Trump's plan to deport as many people as possible. But they are facing resistance here because of existing sanctuary law. So this was part of a filing in which they were listing off several reasons of things that they cannot get into, and ICE said that they had received information that Mayor Brandon Johnson's office had contracted with some kind of video company to film arrests for the purpose of trying to see if any CPD officers were involved and to discipline them. Now, I will say there was no information about who is this company, where information about the contract. The mayor's office, of course, said that no, they have not hired anyone. The ACLU of Illinois said that it was a bit ironic that ICE was making this claim, because, of course, we all saw that in the days after Trump was inaugurated, they came here to Chicago with film crews, including Dr. Phil. And they were filming all of these arrests happening in the Chicago area.
Yeah, rich coming from them, considering what we know. Melody, City Council voted this week to block January 6th rioters from holding city jobs, a 44-3 vote. Mm-hmm. Any sense of how many people that might impact?
We don't really know. You know, it was about 1,500 people that were pardoned in total by President Trump. I don't really know how many of those are gunning for Chicago to come and work for city government. But I think that various of the aldermen thought it was important to take a stance to say that those individuals should not be, you know, having taxpayer funded jobs.
Who were the three alders that voted against them? Do we have a sense
of? It was the three far northwest side aldermen: Alderman Anthony Napolitano, Nicholas Spizzato, and Jim Garner. They represent an area of the city where there are a lot of police officers and firefighters who live. Perhaps an interesting data point, given that nearly 150 officers were injured during the Capitol insurrection, and of course, five died as a result of their injuries from that tragic day.
Heather, you've also been looking at the cost of police misconduct, what it's costing the city. What'd you find?
Well, it is the entire annual budget to cover police misconduct settlements and verdicts was $82 million. Today is April 19th, I believe. Money is exhausted. It has all been spent. And that is raising real questions about where the rest of the money is going to come, because we know that the city council is going to be asked to resolve other lawsuits. It's also possible that they will be asked to pay more than $200 million in jury verdicts before the end of the year. And it's not clear where the city will get that money, given that the city is in a somewhat serious, I think is probably understating it, financial crisis. It also raises real questions about the city's ability to manage the risk and how the police department operates on our streets.
Melody, new plan being floated by Second Ward Alderman Brian Hopkins, looking to expand police powers to declare curfews. What is he proposing?
So this initially started about last year when Alderman Hopkins wanted to implement an 8 p.m. curfew for downtown as a result of teen trends that were happening in his ward. And so that failed pretty instantly. And so there has been some incidents in Streeterville where he wanted to revive it. Some collaboration with the mayor's office, they said they reached a compromise, and he introduced an ordinance that would basically allow the police department to implement this situational traveling curfew. So let's say they receive information that there might be a youth gathering in a certain neighborhood during a particular time. They can implement a curfew for whatever time on whatever date to correspond with that event. There's been some concerns from advocates that I have talked to that this gives police a little bit too much power to possibly profile youth because it says advocates that I have spoken to had said, how do we know, how do we give the power for someone to say that they can decide what's going to incite violence or problems and what is not?
Just going to say that the police department already has the authority to declare gatherings to be unlawful and to order people to disperse. And that is, in fact, what they've done when things have gotten out of control in Streeterville. I know that Alderman Hopkins has told a lot of reporters that this is a compromise measure that has some level of support in the mayor's office. The mayor was questioned about that very closely after the city council meeting. I get paid to listen to the mayor. I did not hear him endorse this plan. And I think that perhaps it is going to be a harder lift to get this through the city council than one would expect to have an ordinance that has 31 co-sponsors at this moment. There are real constitutional questions about the police department's ability to sort of decide what is First Amendment protected activity and what is not First Amendment protected activity. The consent decree involves rules about when police can declare people to be unlawfully loitering, which is certainly sort of, you know, part and parcel of this. So I think this will not be the last week in review that we talk about the issue of curfews in Chicago.
Oh. Maybe Nick will be back next time.
Maybe he will.
All right. That is a week in review. Thank you, everybody. Steve Daniels, Heather Sharoon, Elvia Mello, and Melody Mercado. Thanks. Good to see you all. And we're back to wrap things up right after this.
Tonight's presentation of Chicago Tonight, Week in Review, is made possible in part by Ann and Rich Carr, BNSF Railway, Francine and Dr. Anthony Brown, and the Mullenhauer Progressive Philanthropic Fund in honor of Ida Mullenhauer, supporting quality journalism. Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation. Additional support is provided by
And that's our show for this Friday night. Stay connected with our reporters and what they're working on by following us on Instagram at WTTW Chicago. Now for the Week in Review, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe. Have a great weekend. The other thing we didn't get to, the teachers' contract was ratified this week. First time in 15 years without a strike vote.
By an overwhelming majority of of the Chicago Teachers Union, which I think is a reflection that the deal sort of addressed their major concerns. We still have to have the Board of Education approve it. That's coming up this week. And of course, they've got to figure out how to pay for it. So, that's no big deal, right? Yeah, we can find that in the couch cushions.
Should be easy.
Yeah.
do we think the Board of Education is going to?
I would be very surprised if they have any problem with it, because that would send everybody back to the drawing board, and I'm not sure that, the management, so to speak, could get anything more or different after nearly a year of really tense negotiations.
Well, and surely if the 30,000 teachers, almost 30,000 teachers, can agree on it, hopefully the 21-member board can as well.
Chicago.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that serves the needs of clients in the Chicago area and throughout the nation.